Hey, What Works listeners. Over the last couple of weeks, I've been sharing some work I've been doing with my husband and Yellow House media partner, Sean. We're calling it Cold Pitch, and it's an experimental project exploring media, curiosity, and identity. And I've got another edition of Cold Pitch for you today. This one is about sharing work and showing up in public online spaces and the many fears that can come with it. If you've ever struggled with conflicting feelings about what you post, how you post, and why you post, this edition is for you. Now, we'll have one more Cold Pitch for you before the end of the year, and then in the new year, I'll be back with more regular What Works episodes and essays. So if you want to keep following along with Cold Pitch and see where this experiment goes next, be sure to subscribe at coldpitch.substack.com. That's coldpitch.substack.com. Now, on with the show. A few months ago, Sean launched a hotline.
Well, to begin with, I'd have to say that calling it a hotline is slightly misleading.
Okay, so it's not a hotline. There's no one on the other end to answer your call, but it is a phone number that you can call to hear a new story or a bit of affirmation from Sean each week.
The origin of the hotline that right now I'm just calling the phone tree was actually with Kate Tyson. We were talking about, Let's back up.
Yeah, let's back up. Sean and I have very different feelings about making media online. I started 20 years ago, and for the last 15 years, it's been part of my daily routine. Sean, on the other hand, has largely avoided making media online. You did the, what was that hashtag project thing that you were doing? 52 weeks, 52 on Instagram?
Well, I've done the 100-day project.
100-day project.
Several years in a row.
Yeah, but that was still like more you focused and less like public focused. And you've never really gotten into a routine around making media that's your own, for public consumption anyway.
Correct.
But that's starting to change. And as we talked about what that change would mean for him, we realized that our fears seem to be different when it comes to showing up online. I fear disappointing people I care about, even people I don't know. I fear forgetting people I don't want to forget. Even people I don't know. I fear hurting people I don't want to hurt. Even people I don't know. And Sean doesn't want to do those things, of course, but his fears take a different shape. This is Cold Pitch, a project about media, curiosity, and identity. I'm Tara McMullen, a writer, podcaster, and critic.
I'm Sean McMullen, a podcast producer, coach, artist.
And we're the co-founders of Yellow House Media, a boutique audio production agency. The experimental media project that is Cold Pitch is something new for Sean. It's a commitment to consistently making stuff online with the intention that people will engage with it. I suppose part of the experiment is just figuring out whether or not he'll eventually enjoy doing that. And we've certainly started off in more familiar territory here. After all, I'm used to creating meandering written and audio essays about work, business, and leadership. Including him in that and taking a closer look at media itself is a very small leap. But at some point soon, I'm going to let him take the lead. What he makes will be different, but it'll still be public in a way he hasn't really been comfortable with in the past. All right, back to the hotline. I mean, phone tree.
All right, so Kate and I were talking about an artist that I follow. Forgive me, my my stumbling through the pronunciation of her name. It's Tamar Etun, E-T-T-U-N.
Tamar Etun is a multidisciplinary artist who explores somatic empathy through textile installation, sculpture, video, and performance.
And somewhere in the process of looking into her practice, her art, I came across this opportunity to give her a telephone number, and she texts you under an alias of a demon called Lilith the Demon. So she'll send a picture of a piece of art that she's done and some sort of like assignment thought. And it was just it's been so much fun. And I've actually texted back and forth with her a couple of times, because if you respond to the text, there is her on the other end. So we were talking about that, Kate and I, and Kate was like, oh yeah, I had a friend once who had a call-in hotline or something that you could call. And I was like, oh man, I would love to do that. That is such a good idea, because immediately it like scratches all of my creative itches, because it's a older piece of technology being reappropriated for a new context, for a new purpose.
I mean, if the man could figure out the workflow to record himself on an audio cassette and physically mail it to you, he would. For heaven's sake, we make podcasts for a living, arguably the most frictionless technology of broadcast media ever conceived. But he loves a little anachronistic challenge.
But then, of course, I was like, what are the technological challenges of actually creating your own phone tree? Like, how do you, I mean, do you have to like call up your telephone provider and set up a phone tree with them? And it seemed like a real big hurdle to overcome. And so it kind of got backburnered for probably a good year. And then I was talking to, and I'm not going to remember who I was talking to. Oh, I remember exactly who I was talking to now. And she was just like, oh, well, you just use Google Voice Attendant. I'm like, oh, okay. And like, I had it set up that day. Like, it was like, yes. So yeah, that's the origin of it.
When you call Sean's phone tree number, which of course is in the show notes, you're greeted by an automated Google Voice Attendant that explains your options.
You have reached the Sean D. McMullen phone tree, the home of dial and affirmation for daily living. You can call this number whenever you are looking for some inspiration, entertainment, or just a little time away from the capitalistic hellscape we call home. Expect fabulously fresh content posted every week on Mondays 10 a.m.-ish East Coast time. We are glad that you found us. Enjoy. Dial 1 to hear this week's fabulously fresh recording about head trash. Dial 2 to hear last week's slightly less fresh but equally fabulous recording about rating systems. Pause for effect. Riveting. Dial 3 to hear a poem by Mary Oliver. Dial 4 to hear some more television nostalgia. One of our favorites. Dial 6 to hear more about Sean's work and other projects. Dial 0 to leave a voicemail or hang up and call back next Monday for more fresh content.
It's a computer speaking these words, and it sounds weird to have a computer-generated voice saying, fabulously fresh content, right? So I kind of lean into that.
This medium, the phone tree, is an interesting choice from the perspective of our hopes and fears around making media online. Many people, and probably most people encountering this project, make media online to be recognized. Whether the reason is marketing, employment opportunities, or just keeping in touch with friends and family, we post to be seen by others we care about. Recognition is a vital human need, argues philosopher Charles Taylor. We crave recognition that reinforces both our equal dignity to others and our unique differences from others. Something especially true today, given how we've abandoned formal hierarchy and fixed status, at least in theory. Today, most of us value the flexibility of our identities. We want to be recognized for the choices we make based on who we know ourselves to be. And digital media indisputably created greater access to this kind of recognition. Even if we're socially isolated where we live or from family, we have a chance to connect with others on our own terms online. We make connections by representing our values, interests, and worldviews in the form of social media. To connect, then, is to be recognized, at least in some small way. What's more, various public-private online platforms make it possible for others to find us and reach out to connect. But Sean's phone tree isn't findable in the same sense. You won't discover it by entering a relevant search term into Google. You're unlikely to just stumble on his website where the number is listed. The phone tree is a medium you have to go looking for, which means you already know it exists, and so you probably already recognize Sean in some way. The phone tree is completely public. Anyone willing to dial a U.S. number can access it. But it's also relatively private.
I think the reason that I have done it that way is, I mean, there's a lot of elements, a lot of places my mind goes. But ultimately, what I want from it is that the people that are listening to it wants to. And it's not like I'm testing them. It's not like I'm putting up barriers for entry. If this is something that is compelling to you, then you're going to listen to it. If you hear this and be like, oh, that's a fucking brilliant idea, you're going to listen to it. And if it's not, you're not. And if it's not, I don't want you to, you know, I'm not trying to trick people into listening to something or trying to convince people that it's something that they should listen to.
I might call what Sean describes here as the desire to be found by the right people. And this desire, of course, implies its opposite. Call it a fear or maybe an aversion, but many people feel anxious about the wrong people finding their work online. The wrong people might leave a heartless comment, attack you or your work, or question your integrity in front of the right people. And at the risk of psychoanalyzing my dear husband, I see his choice to create the phone tree as both a positivist artistic choice and a way to allay his concern about being exposed to people who don't get it in distasteful, harmful, or even violent ways. And honestly, I do exactly the same thing, just in a different form. My own voice, topic choice, and content structure are based on what I love. They're stylistic choices more than they are strategic product choices. But at the same time, I know that my style limits who comes in contact with me and my work. The odds that I get shouted down by some hyper-capitalist tech bro Elon Musk superfan are extremely low. How would they even find me in the first place? And why would they start listening to or reading my work? I, too, want to be recognized by the right people and not by the wrong people. Now, despite his anxieties, Sean has been working on showing up in more online spaces over the last 6 months. He started with private online communities, moved on to Zoom coffee dates, developed a routine for LinkedIn, launched the phone tree, and now we're doing this cold pitch thing. So, how's it feeling?
I'll be honest, it's a little like pulling teeth. This is not something that I come by easily. It's not something that I am easily compelled to do.
It's pulling teeth for you?
For me.
To do it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But it goes back to what we were talking about, is that the inspiration comes from the work. The results come from the work, right? And so I can acknowledge and identify that there's something that I want and that this is a avenue towards that. And to be like clear, like showing up is effectively like social networking as a form of marketing, right? And which is really interesting to me in that it is for me, it's an authentic way of interacting with people. And so the end goal being, I want people to know about Cold Pitch, Yellow House Media, and my coaching practice. How are people going to know about those things unless I put that information is put in front of them? And so LinkedIn, I was going to tell you, I'm up to 88 connections. But there's this thing that, like, today I reached out to somebody and asked them to connect. I messaged them and I said, hey, so good to see you. It's been so long. And their reaction was, I'm surprised that you even remember who I am. She didn't think that I would even remember who she was. And I'm like, of course I remember who you are. How's your husband doing? Blah, blah, blah. You know, she told me what's going on with her. I told her what's going on with me. I said, hey, good to see you out here. If you ever want to have coffee, let me know. And then I'm done. And then that's it. And now that I'm connected and I'm following with her on LinkedIn, and that's just sort of, it really fits with my proclivities. And, but there's like other places that I'm getting myself out there, you know. For me, it's an authentic way of interacting with people. I have a daily reminder to do it. It's mm-hmm. My daily reminder is engage. And then I have a limit on how long I stay there. Right now, my limit to LinkedIn is 10 minutes. I start a timer, 10 minutes, and I read other people's things. I give some thumbs up. I comment where I will feel like it's appropriate. And it's harder for me to post my own stuff because I don't really have a whole lot to save there. But I'll try to do that once a week. And then 10 minutes is up, and then I turn it off and I walk away. If nothing else, it's been an education about what's going on out in the world. It keeps me connected and aware of the good and the bad. But yeah, it's been going really well.
Okay, so the other day you told me that you realized that part of what makes it difficult for you to create media for public consumption in a visible way or show up in online spaces is that you really, really value your anonymity. And at the same time, you really crave friendship, social interaction, connecting with people. It is a huge part of who you are and something you don't get enough of. And I'm curious how you see the relationship between those two values. On one hand, the value for anonymity, and on the other hand, the value for substantial social connection.
I struggle a little bit with this question because I'm in sort of an angsty place when it comes to my level of connection with people. And I'm also aware coming out of pandemic times that I have become a homebody when I don't want to be, but yet when I have an opportunity to see and be around people, I kind of freak out a little. The anxiety of being around other people is something that I'm experiencing in a way that I hadn't before. So I just wanted to say that like my relationship with anonymity and also community and people knowing me, but like in really incomplete thought, let's unpack that here, is that there's something about the type of connection that I like that allows for it to be real. That these are based upon real connections. That there is actually a reason that this person that I've connected with, this person, and this person is part of my friendship circle, what have you. So that, like, you know, our next door neighbor is leaving. Is she sold her house and she's moving. And that really bums me out because I have a connection with her and who knows what the next thing's going to be. But I've also been thinking a lot about how anonymity doesn't demand much of you and that I tend to lean towards things that don't really demand much of me. And this is a whole big thing to unpack, but also I have historically pursued relationships that don't demand very much of me. And so what I have been processing lately is how, yeah, I like anonymity, but why? And is it that I like community and connection, but only when I can control it? And so the opposite of anonymity to me feels like a loss of control over my space, my time, my body. And I've been thinking a lot about that fuzzy line between those two things. So I've been trying to allow myself to be a little less anonymous. Because I think that there's a way that I can be known, and I use that term loosely, but also still protect my time, my space, and still control over, have some control. Just because the opposite of anonymity doesn't mean like stardom. There's like a significant, like I'm not going to be walking down the street, and having people demand to take pictures of me. There's a very large spectrum between those two things, right? And so while last week I think I said I would really appreciate my anonymity, I think a much clearer way to put it is that I have never aspired towards any sort of anything resembling stardom. I don't want to be, I don't know what to call it. I don't want to be an online personality. I don't want to be, do not want to be an influencer. Like, these are things that to me sound awful. And that doesn't mean that I have to have it. There is something different than just anonymity.
Let's revisit the idea that recognition is a vital human need, that we all want to be recognized for both our dignity and our difference in a way that feels true to us. Now, is a celebrity recognized in that way? Or an influencer? Or even a super niche performance artist you follow on Instagram? No, I don't think so. We can recognize their persona. We can identify them as a standardized, flattened version of who we must presume is a multifaceted person. We might even view all of their public activity as a performance of self. But we don't recognize them in the way we crave being recognized. Charles Taylor, the philosopher I mentioned earlier, argues that our individual identities are formed both through recognition and through misrecognition. Taylor writes that a person can suffer real damage, real distortion, if the people or society around them mirror back to them a confining or demeaning or contemptible picture of themselves. Being misrecognized can trap us in a false, distorted, and reduced mode of being, even to the point of internalized self-hatred. It's this kind of misrecognition that we experience when someone mistakes one of our identities for our whole identity. For instance, imagine someone who believes that all mothers would prefer to stay home with their children, and that preference characterizes their view of the economy, their job, and their personal finances. If this person learns that I'm a mother, they'll come to all sorts of incorrect conclusions about my preferences and worldview. Now, it's one thing to shake off a single person's misrecognition, but it's quite another to shake off institutional or societal misrecognition. In that case, misrecognition can seep into our identities and limit who we believe we can be. So, at best, misrecognition is frustrating. But at worst, misrecognition imposes a restricted and constrained identity on those being misrecognized. We can internalize the way others perceive people like us and lose the ability to imagine our identities outside that narrow class. The desire for anonymity is a guard against misrecognition. And there are many very legitimate reasons to desire anonymity and avoid misrecognition. But there are also reasons to desire anonymity, like maintaining control, that make it much harder to be legitimately recognized in the ways we might want. Now seems like a good time to remind you that Sean is a 6-foot-tall, white, cis, straight man with a big, full beard, blue eyes, and a smile that puts people at ease. In other words, he exudes privilege. He has the privilege of almost never being misrecognized in a way that puts him at risk of harm. There are very few rooms, literal or metaphorical, that he walks into in which he wouldn't feel comfortable stating an opinion or asking a question. Lots of people don't have that privilege, though. However, online spaces have made it possible for more of us with fewer layers of privilege to show up, share our thoughts, and be seen. We have a bigger, more accessible public square than we've ever had, for both good and for ill.
Problem with those places is that they were also, like the problems that we're running into with social media, is that they're very dominated by a certain group of people. Mm-hmm. And so like a public square wouldn't have been safe for everyone to go to be able to voice their opinion. They might have even been prohibited. And so the democratization of the online, yeah, hell yeah. And it's taken advantage of by a lot of really ugly people. And so there is a significant degree of ugliness in it. And back to like with the anonymity thing, mm-hmm. that's the other thing that I'm afraid of the anything that's not anonymous, is that I'm afraid of becoming a target of those people.
I think the fear of becoming a target might also be understood as a fear of weaponized misrecognition. I want you to speak more about this fear of becoming a target. Like, where does that fear come from? Is it just a general ambiguous anxiety about the fact that, yes, there are trolls in the online spaces? Or do you know people who have been targeted? Do you have an experience of being targeted? Where does that fear of becoming a target come from?
You know, I don't know. That's a really good question, because I've never had any personal experience with it. I can tell you, definitely not trolls per se. I mean, I don't have any personal experience with it, but I do have clients who have gotten, maybe not them, but like people who have been on their podcast who have gotten death threats, mm-hmm. People who have been doxxed, you know, like that I know of and have had conversations with people who have been really aggressively targeted.
And we should probably be clear that these are people predominantly that hold marginalized identities, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so I have observed that. I would say that on a much more benign level, like I was thinking, so it's like, say if I'm in a online community and I'm on like a Zoom call, and somebody says something that's just like, man, that was dumb. And they say something to me. And like, I know how when it's face to face, I know how to diffuse things. I don't really know what to say to somebody who is, you know, has a handle that says, you know, whatever, like this one. Y-addle-y number, 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 number.
Oh, you mean just like a dumb handle?
Yeah, just like a dumb handle of somebody that says unsolicited advice of like, come on. But I don't know where that fear comes from. I just think I'm afraid of people being mean to me.
Are you afraid that people won't like you?
I think that's like a bigger thing. Yeah. Like if it's, I guess as we're talking about like this, is if like if I put myself out there and I say I'm talking about, like, say, like, trans rights, gender identity, and somebody disagrees with me and gets mean about it, I am very comfortable and confident in saying, tell them to go fuck themselves.
Right.
But it is harder for me when it's like I say something and they're like, you know, that thing that you put out, that's not very good. I don't know why you bother. You know, like, that to me would hurt more.
Here, Sean is making the distinction between two fears. One is a fear of the attention that can come from sticking up for others, and he's less fearful of this kind of attention. The other is the fear of having someone confirm his doubts about the thing he made and shared with the world, and he's more fearful of this kind of attention. Again, I think Taylor's theory of recognition can be helpful for parsing this. The way I understand Sean's reply is that standing up for others or for what he believes in is a way of confirming his identity and being recognized for his deepest beliefs. He's recognized even if by people who vehemently disagree with him. But being told that his work isn't good or interesting hurts because it feels like misrecognition. That type of negative feedback takes an expansive and multifaceted identity and squeezes it into something smaller and constrained. Again, one nasty comment or email might do some damage. But the more one is exposed to that kind of feedback, the more likely one is to internalize that constrained identity. And that's one thing for Sean as a straight white male with that smile that puts people at ease. But it's another for those who don't experience the social benefit of the doubt that he does. Charles Taylor distinguishes between the principle of equal dignity and the principle of difference. He notes that those who aim to elevate the principle of equal dignity, even equal human potential, above the principle of difference often ignore the ways equal dignity is contingent on assimilating to the dominant culture. In other words, in order to benefit from systems that prize equality, many of us have to make ourselves appear less different. And that takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of emotional, cultural, even aesthetic work. When Sean posts something to a public online space, he benefits from the ease by which he's afforded equal dignity. People are more likely to treat his differences more charitably. But when a Black woman or an Indigenous trans woman posts something to a public online space, they are much more likely to face both the pressure to appease dominant culture and an erasure of their difference. And while Sean and I were talking about his fears, we realize that by virtue of his identities, he has less practice being misrecognized than many other people do.
Yeah. So I wanted to just put that out there that, like, I am processing this right now.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting that I think we've gotten to a point with this that we haven't gotten to before, not that I've heard anyway. And so I'm trying to, like, probe it in real time.
Sure.
Too. I wrote down the word safety while you were speaking. And I think that there's the physical safety component, which you were just speaking to. And I think that that's maybe something that you see as more of a possibility via online media than you do in the analog world, because in the analog world, you hold all the dominant identities, and your risk of physical safety in daily interactions outside of the computer world is very low.
Negligible,
unless you provoke someone, right?
Yeah.
But even then, like, you don't need to have a fear of calling the cops. You don't need to worry about calling an EMT or whatever it might be that other people might. And I think one of the interesting things about the online space that, sure, it's created a place where people control and dox and say stupid shit. But more than that, it's given people who hold marginalized identities a voice that they don't feel safe necessarily having in the analog world. And I guess in my head, like, I'm wondering about the politics of how people who hold marginalized identities take up space online, and completely recognizing that that's fraught in its own way as well, but having more safety in taking up space online versus the politics of a straight white dude, or marginally straight white dude, and coming into the online space and feeling those sort of questions around safety more acutely than you do in the quote-unquote real world. Does that make sense?
It does. And it's really nice to have someone point out that one of the things that might be frustrating to me about the digital world is that all of the control that I rely on a regular basis, this is like, meh, life isn't the way that I like it, want it to be. I'm a white dude. That's hard. Meh. And yeah. And for me to have to be in spaces that are uncomfortable, that's a good thing. I'm very conflict adverse in general. And in the analog world, I know the rules. I know how this works. I know how to navigate this place. I know what places not to go to. That's a biker bar. I'm not going in there, right? The digital world is, I will be honest, the online world is still has a lot of unknowns to me. And it's not so much that conflict doesn't exist in one space and exists in the other space. It's that in one space, I have learned how to avoid it. And this actually gets tied back into what we're talking about with anonymity and being a homebody, in that the side effect of that ability to avoid conflict in the meat space is that you don't go anywhere that's challenging. Whereas that luxury doesn't, like, the challenge comes to you on the online world.
Sean is able to avoid conflict in the analog world because he knows the rules. The rules were made for people like him. And there is a wealth of spaces he can enter where the conflict doesn't come to him. For underrecognized and historically marginalized people, there are very few spaces that offer a reliably conflict-free zone. Many people can't go to the DMV or the grocery store or restaurant without expecting that conflict will come to them. While I was talking to Sean about his fears, I realized that he has a lot less practice being misrecognized than people with less privilege. He's less accustomed to the kind of work that underrecognized people do every single day, online and off. The online world feels uncomfortable because it's uncomfortable for him to be visible in a place that seems less safe than he's used to being. The rules of online spaces are still largely written with people like him in mind. But there are more spaces where underrecognized people take the lead and write their own rules. Some of those spaces are private, but many of them are hiding in plain sight. Sean is right to be hesitant to learn more about the rules of the spaces he enters before he contributes an opinion. After all, it's an experience that's familiar to lots of people. To state what I hope is obvious, not everyone needs to or wants to show up online and share their thoughts publicly. And yet, as I mentioned earlier, online media presents an incredible opportunity for those of us who crave being seen on our own terms. Whether it's social media or podcasting or writing or other forms of digital media, we have new and more accessible ways to connect with others who recognize us. And we also have the opportunity to recognize others as they share their work and identities. Now, Charles Taylor makes the point that pop culture preaches a view of self-actualization and identity that springs from an always already existing essence. When we talk about being true to ourselves or acting authentically, we tend to reference some immutable internal monologue about who we really are. Taylor says we give far too much credence to this perspective. Instead, he emphasizes that identity is born from dialogue with others, both real and imagined. We learn who we are through interaction with our caregivers, friends, partners, and children. We also learn who we are based on a dialogical relationship with institutions and culture, including media. If making stuff online exposes us to misrecognition and dialogue with those who may belittle, attack, or dispute in bad faith, then a certain fear of loathing is justified. But is succumbing to that fear worth giving up the possible recognition and constructive dialogue with people who are willing to see us and our work in good faith? Does the fear that I might be targeted justify not sharing work that might help others receive the benefits of recognition? Everyone needs to find their own answers to those questions. But for me, the benefits of making public work online outweigh my fear of loathing. I'll take the risk of being targeted if it means I can be recognized and recognize others in affirming ways.
I'm just not somebody who experiences much of anything resembling stage fright. That's never really been a thing of mine. Like, it's so funny to hear the contradictions in the things that I'm saying, because like on one hand I'm like, oh, don't look at me, I want my anonymity, but at the same time I'm like, eh, whatever, you know. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad people are listening, reading. I hope that they read more, listen more.
You've been listening to Cold Pitch, a project of Yellow House Media that explores media, curiosity, and identity. You can find us on Substack at coldpitch.substack.com or learn more about our audio production agency, Yellow House Media, at yellowhouse.media. You can also find my other media project, What Works, at whatworks.fyi. And you can find out more about Sean's coaching at seandmcmullen.com. Cold Pitch is a production of Yellow House Media. Today's piece was hosted by Sean McMullen and me, Tara McMullen. I also wrote and edited today's episode. Our team includes Lou Blazer, Emily Kilduff, and Marty Seafelt. We live and work on the stolen land of the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples, and the Yellow House is located on the unceded territory of the Kutunaha Nation and the tribes of the Salish and Kalispell.